Hi, this is Bethany Wilkinson. Welcome to the Diversity Gap Podcast, the home of race-conscious leadership. Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Diversity Gap Podcast. I am so thrilled that you are here, and I'm really looking forward to sharing today's conversation with you. Earlier this week, I had the privilege of interviewing Sean Watkins, who is the Director of Training and Strategy at Be the Bridge, a faith-based nonprofit that exists to empower people and culture toward racial healing, equity, and reconciliation. I have followed the work of Be the Bridge for many years now, and what I love about their work is that they are relentless in their truth-telling, as well as in their loving and powerful invitations for us as individuals and as organizations to play our part in closing diversity gaps and in addressing the many racial injustices of our time. They do it with such passion, with such conviction, with such deep roots in a faith tradition and in community. Their work is just incredibly rich. And so it was such an honor to learn from Sean in today's conversation. Now, before I share the conversation, I do want to share a quick announcement, which is that for those of you who are looking for seasons 1 and 2 of the Diversity Gap podcast, you'll find that they're not live in the feed on whatever player you're looking for or whatever player you're using. You'll have to visit www.thediversitygap.com/podcast. And when you go to that page, you'll be able to access all of the archived season 1 and season 2 episodes. So if you're looking for those, I just want to put a plug in here to say, hey, they're on the internet still. You just have to go to the Diversity Gap website to access them. There are also transcripts available there for you. So if you're looking for the old episodes, that's where you can check them out. Now, back to the conversation we're having today. I know that we are coming off of a week, really, of processing a tremendous amount of pain and disappointment and heartache and loss. I'm specifically talking about the incident of anti-Black racist terror that happened in Buffalo, which if you haven't heard about, which I'm sure you have, but if you haven't heard about, I'm not going to get into the details here because I'm not a journalist and I don't feel qualified to explain it from that point of view. But in my own process, it has been really important and helpful for me to make sense of this incident in the context of community. And so my conversation with Sean today was just such a gift because he and I were able to talk about what it has meant for us to move forward as two Black people in the United States who are also, you know, leading in diversity, equity, racial justice work. We just spent some time processing that and making sense of what it means for us as individuals and how we're moving forward. In this conversation, we talk about a lot of other really beautiful and important things as well. And so I hope that you are able to find a little nugget of encouragement, of direction, of inspiration in this conversation. I may say this every week, but it really was one of my favorite interviews to date. And so I, again, hope that you are able to find something that really supports your journey in this conversation between me and Sean. And I also hope that you are moving with such gentleness and care for yourself and those around you. We are living through really difficult, painful times, and I don't want to diminish that in any way, while also inviting us to find our footing and our power in the context of our relationships with one another. So without further ado, I hope that you enjoy this conversation between me and Sean Watkins. So, Sean Watkins, welcome to the Diversity Gap podcast. We were just talking about how we're doing, but I'll ask again, how are you today?
Hi, Bethany. It is good to finally see you face to face and not just over email correspondence to meet and to be here. I am truly humbled and honored, I think, for the opportunity to be able to talk about this incredible resource and the work that both of us are doing and both of our organizations are doing in the country. Overall, I'm doing well. I was telling a friend of mine, today feels very weird because one, we're getting to the podcast episode together, and then I will start teaching a class at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary this Wednesday called Christianity and the Problem of Racism. And so it feels weird to be in the midst of those two realities as we're coming off of Buffalo this past weekend, that in the midst of doing this work, as you know, working with organizations, just as we do at Be the Bridge, and trying to both move people and culture, I think, towards being aware of these realities, that even in the midst of doing the work and feeling like, you know, we're having some fruitful conversations, we're seeing organizations shift and change, that we can still have an 18-year-old young man go to Buffalo and go to a predominantly Black neighborhood and, you know, take the lives of 10 Black people in the country. And so it feels weird. It's in the juxtaposition of like peril and progress, right? We're making so much progress in some ways, but there's still a lot of peril happening in the country. So I think just kind of living in those two tensions as we get ready to start the conversation and topic for today. So how about you? How are you doing as you come in?
Yes. Oh gosh. Thanks for asking. You know, you really took us right in to the heart of how I'm feeling and how I'm showing up today. I was literally, I had the privilege yesterday of interviewing one of my great uncles about life and the state of race in America. He's in his 70s and he's from South Georgia. And we were just talking about community connection and race in America. And he was saying from his perspective, he feels like this time is harder and more difficult than the movement he grew up in. Yeah. And that really frustrated me. But it was also an invitation for me to be honest about the amount of grief I was carrying.
Yeah.
And so I spent a good bit of yesterday just feeling really sad and, and feeling that tension. Like I'm working day in and day out with organizations and leaders and people who are making these incredible and beautiful strides towards more equity and towards confronting racism. And then in an instant, I can feel like, what am I doing? This is a waste of time. I'm going to go garden and not talk to anyone about race ever again. And so, that's how I am. I'm showing up today, feeling all of those things. And I did clear my schedule this morning. So it was really open, which I needed that space before our conversation. And so, that's where I'm at today.
I overstand. I agree wholeheartedly. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd love for you, in this vein, to kind of orient me and even our listeners to who you are, the work you do. And then I will probably have more questions about that as you unpack who you are and what you do. But tell us a little bit about you and your work.
Sure. Absolutely. Be glad to. I'll give you the professional version and then I'll give you the unfiltered version. So professionally, I'm the director of training and strategy at Be the Bridge, faith-based nonprofit started by Latosha Morrison, author of book of the same name, Be the Bridge. And so, and being over training and strategy, I'm over our training team and the primary trainer that we have to work with organizations and churches, again, similar to you in terms of faith-based or non-faith-based, for-profit, nonprofit, and we really want to move people and culture on this journey to embracing the principles of racial healing, racial equity, and racial reconciliation. And so it's been a number of days, weeks, hours, all the time, really is kind of committed to both learning about that field and then producing resources, I think, to help develop folks in that field. I've got a bachelor's in African American Studies and History from the University of Texas. I've got a master's of divinity with a concentration in cultural ethics from Fuller Seminary, and I'm a PhD student in their intercultural studies program also at Fuller, and I'm studying the intersectionality of African American culture, faith, and ethics. That's a long way of being able to say slavery ended in 1865, 246 years. When we hit 246 years of freedom, it'll be 2111. And so the further we get away from being in bondage and the Black diaspora begins to emerge in the United States with all the racial turmoil that you and I were just talking about, what are our core values? What are our ethics? Are they very much the same or are they shifting? And I think a case can be made that they are shifting in the country, but what are they shifting to? And so I'm very curious about that. I spent 12 years working as a college pastor with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And so I kind of was on staff with them and led a ministry for Black students at UT and oversaw a ministry to Black college students in Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. And I was a part of the mass exodus of that white evangelical space when the 45th president came down the escalator and made all of his remarks. And so in that process, I realized the things that were important to me as a college student and the things that were important when I was a campus minister, they have fundamentally shifted in the last 10 to 15 years. And so if that's the case, you know, I think we hear a lot of the conversations coming out of church and seminary that we've lost a generation. I don't think that we've lost them. I think that they need something specifically that the church fundamentally does not see, doesn't recognize, that some of our institutions don't see and don't recognize. And so I'm curious about what those are, because we need their voices. We will pass the mantle of leadership to them. And if we cannot build a bridge in between those two generations, we're just going to have some gaps in terms of ethics, theology, faith, leadership, and all of those things. So that's me professionally, off the record. What I always tell people is, dad was a lawyer, mom was a teacher, and I'm the product of both of them for their second marriage. Dad's an alcoholic and never been in recovery. And he had an affair when I was a kid, and parents divorced. We moved in with my grandmother in the hood. And my mom just didn't have a whole lot of family support. And it was the 80s. I'm 39. I'll be 40 in October. And she started using drugs when I was 5. And so the whole crack epidemic that hit the Black community in the 80s hit my house. And so she was on drugs from the time I was 5 until the time I was 30. And so my foundational years kind of growing up really was two very well-educated parents. Again, dad's a lawyer, mom's a teacher with a master's degree. They both are very well educated, and I feel like they gave me upper middle class Black family values, but the context where those got lived out was the hood. And so that was kind of my introduction to diversity and culture, because, you know, you have all of these rules that, you know, if you come from a specific socioeconomic background or status, there are all these rules that apply in the suburbs. And when you get to the hood, that stuff does not work. You don't run stop signs. There are no rolling stops in the suburbs. You stop at every red light. In Third Ward in Houston, Texas, if you certain lights, you have to run or you will be robbed. you can't go to that gas station at a certain point in time. And so for me, that was the beginnings of, so culture depends a lot on location. And so it became kind of that decoder ring for me, and got to college and found some African-American studies courses, and my faith took off, and I realized the need to contextualize the things that I was learning, and it shaped the course of my life. And I have been doing that ever since. So that is a long preamble to my life, but that's kind of me in a nutshell. So,
I appreciate you breaking that down, because there is such richness. And I do find that for people who do this sort of work, you know, we're training, we're coaching, we're developing resources. It often comes from a very deep personal place where we were asking questions when we were very small. Mm-hmm. And like, why is the world like this? and how did it get this way? And what's my part in it? And how those questions really do inform how we show up to this work. And the lack of those questions also informs why some people aren't participating.
Factual facts. Yes.
You know? Yeah. Oh, so you said so many things that I'm curious about. But I want you first, I guess, to take me into, you were saying that, as you know, we're getting further away from bondage, African-American Black communities, we have this space to define our values, if that's how you said it. And I'd love to hear more about that. Like, what's your thinking on that? We talk a lot about values here on the Diversity Gap podcast, mostly in the organizational context, but given the diversity of Black identity in U.S. society, I'm just curious, you know, what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I am wrestling with that and trying to unpack those things myself. I think there's a theologian professor named Dr. Carl Ellis, who's a professor of African-American church history and theology at Redeemer Theological Seminary, if I'm not mistaken. He lives in Tennessee, and is just a mentor and a good friend of mine. And I remember probably it was around 2014 or 2015, shortly after Michael Brown had been killed. And so we're having a conversation at a conference, and he began to talk about what he called these cultural core concerns of African-Americans. And it's a broader emphasis that'll take up too much time in the podcast. But essentially what he talks about is just kind of the realities that we all have these concerns, and they are the basis for our ethics, for our theology. You know, some of us have the bare necessities, food, water, shelter, clothing. In the United States, we believe folks should have access to clean drinking water, to a quality education. If you call the police, they should show up and save your life and not take your life if you call them for help. Different things like that. But when it comes to specific ethnic groups, each of us have different cultural core concerns that when you speak to those, you will get our attention. And so what Dr. Ellis argues is that those cultural core concerns for Black people are dignity, identity, and significance. Dignity, that we're made in God's image. We're not 3/5 of a person. And so as a consequence, our lives are infinitely valuable, not more valuable than anybody else's, but infinitely valuable. Dignity, and then identity. that Black is beautiful. It is a culture, and that to talk about diversity, reconciliation, inclusion does not mean that we have to check our Blackness at the door. That does not mean that I have to assimilate to the dominant culture. As a matter of fact, he says for Black folks and for Latinx folks, everybody else can melt in that melting pot, but for Black and Brown folks, we don't melt, we burn. And we see that reality when it comes to the attempts to have Black culture and Latinx culture assimilate. And then the last thing really is significance, that for African-American theology and Christians, our frameworks revolve around the Exodus and the exile. What does it mean that we are descendants of enslaved peoples? And then also, what does it mean that we're strangers in a land that we've called home for the last 400 years? And so he's a man that was educated in the 60s and started thinking theologically 70s, 80s, 90s, on up until today. And while he's brilliant and we tease him about him, he's in the third or fourth quarter of his life. Don't drop kick me, Dr. Ellis, you know I love you. So, but he's in a different age and stage of his life. And so I think, you know, precisely to your point, 60 years ago to be Black in America meant just that. It meant the descendants of slaves. Today, it means a number of things. We've got Black folks that transcend race, our Oprahs, Shaq, Jay-Z, and the queen herself, Beyonce. We've got people who live in abject poverty. We've got people who are biracial, who are second and third generation African immigrants. And we've got upper middle class Black people that they're doing well for themselves. They've got the picket fence, the nice house, the two cars. If they both lose their jobs in 2 years, they could very easily be poor again because we don't have that equity in our families. And so Black has changed without question, I think, in the United States. I also think if you look at, let's say it's 2022 right now, let's go back 21 years to 2001. If somebody was born in 2001, they got here when 9/11 happened. They saw Barack Obama become president. They saw Donald Trump become president. They've seen the Black Lives Matter movement. They've seen Me Too. They've seen same-sex marriage become legal. They have seen a frequency of not just unarmed shootings of African-Americans. They've seen shootings in schools. They've seen us separate children from their parents at the borders for California and Texas and Mexico. All of these social issues that should happen one in a generation, they've seen all of them in the last 21 years. And so I think when we talk about what does it mean to recruit, retain, and promote African-Americans on our jobs? What does it mean to have Black people coming into our churches and our institutions? I don't think we can simply say you're made in God's image, Black is beautiful, and that y'all are descendants of slaves, or sometimes considered strangers in your own land. We've got to talk about patriarchy. We've got to talk about sexism. We've got to talk about Christian hegemony, the fact that, Christians, evangelical Christians in particular, believe that they should have the dominant decision-making power, kind of all of the realities that you talk about in the book. What exactly are we going to be liberated from? I think this generation, they have come on the scene and they are allergic to the racism, the patriarchy, the indecisiveness that exists in too many of our institutions, whether they are Christian or secular. And they are saying, if you cannot address these issues and come up with solutions to these systemic and structural problems, we want nothing to do with you, your businesses, your wisdom, and your resources. You're just repeating the same systems and cycles of brokenness, and they want no part of it. And so I'm just curious about that. There's this generation that I think Dr. King said about once every 50 years, God brings just a prophetic generation on the earth that are like, throw everything away, the baby, the bathwater, and the house, burn it all down, we'll start over, right? So I'm like, hey, before you burn it down, one, I'm still here, I'm in that house. But also, why are they saying those things? What is it that we need to learn from them? How can we help them? We need their energy, they need our wisdom. And so I'm just curious about that. I don't have the answers for it, but that's the whiteboard in front of me. We can all feel it, I think, as Gen Z continues to grow up every single day. They are challenging us in ways in which I think we have to pay attention to if we're going to lead and lead well.
Mm-hmm. You walking through all of the things that Gen Z has lived through, like in the time, because I was probably 11, 10 or 11 when 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
I just haven't thought about it like that. Yeah. Like, this is a lot that we have lived through.
It's a lot. Yeah.
It is a lot that we have lived through, and it is really tricky to slow down enough to help people make space to understand it. And saying that, I'm thinking about executive leadership teams and boards of directors who, they've seen a lot of what's going on, but because of where they're at in their position or how long they've been doing it, they have a bit of security despite the world seeming like it's falling apart or the world actually falling apart. Yeah. And And I wonder if you see this when you're working with institutions. It's yes, there's resistance, but there's also just this lack of capacity to make room for the amount of complexity that's in the room. Is that we want to talk about diversity, but we don't want to talk about the realities that Gen Z that we're facing. And it just, I see this lack of capacity, and that's something that I'm trying to solve for in my own work. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Whew, good night. That's a conference theme right there. We need some time to go away and unpack that one. I see it all the time, I think, in organizations. You know, the reality is, I think when we do this work, the majority of organizations that come to us are majority white. And I think it'd be the bridge because, again, similar to y'all, we've got some faith-based components that I think are a part of the work that we do. We have a lot of predominantly white churches that are coming to us as well, too. And the overwhelming majority, like 99% of them, are teachable. Like, they are legit curious. They want to grow in these areas. The capacity is not there. I think the awareness is not there as well, too. These institutions, these leaders, if you will, pastors, the people who are running these organizations and companies, my heart breaks for them in some ways because you realize that they were prepared to lead in a world that never existed. They were never taught or trained to have eyes to see and ears to hear the rich tapestry that exists in the United States of America. We know that whiteness is considered to be universal and normative. And so they have spent their entire lives not thinking about crossing cultures, not having teachers of a different ethnic or cultural background, not having a supervisor of an ethnic and cultural background. And so how they approach time, decision-making, communication, all of the things that the BIPOC community almost intrinsically, instinctively knows because we live our lives in perpetual displacement. And we've known this from day one. You know, a Black mama, a Black parent tells you what happens when you leave this house. If you see law enforcement, we have been taught to code switch. And so we've got some executive leaders that have been successful. They have, you know, been in leadership for 30 or 40 years. They've made six figures, seven figures. They've got houses all over the country. They have multiple degrees, but it's prepared them for a world that doesn't exist. And so now as they're thinking about legacy and they're getting ready to retire, and we're like, yeah, you didn't do anything with diversity. It fundamentally, there isn't a capacity and awareness. It's an entirely different frame of reference for them. And so it's very difficult for folks to be able to recognize that. I always coach people to be able to practice displacement. Like, the first thing you need to be able to do, go to a Black church and sit there. Go to a Spanish speaking church and sit there. It's like, oh, we do mission trips all the time. No. They know you're coming. They know how much money you have. They're going to be nice to you because it's America, and they know if you get upset, you'll take your donations with you. Stay there for a year. I coach people, I'm like, stay in a place long enough to where the power and influence that you have cannot affect a change or a decision that needs to take place in that company or in that church. And when you're there long enough and you are powerless to affect change, then you will know what displacement is like. And so I tend to find that when they are not leading in the room, when they're not dominating the conversation, when they have to practice humility, then that tends to open up a little bit of the capacity for them. There's also something about, I think you talk about in the book, which I really appreciate too. It's just the realities of embodiment. I think it very much is a cerebral task for a lot of our executives right now. And so intellectually, they're still thinking about it. And that's an idol of, I think, a Eurocentric and a patriarchal society, this idol of intellectualism that we can think our way out of the solution. Psychologists, and I think what you talk about in your book is true. The Body Keeps Score, and I've forgotten the author's name, but it's a phenomenal book. And they just talk about the realities of you are a whole person. And so you have to pay attention to what's going on in your body as also what's going on in your mind as well, too. And so I think because folks live such a compartmentalized life and they have been educated to do that, mm-hmm. as a consequence, that capacity just isn't as high. And so I try to lead with, again, the realities of you've been prepared for a world that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And that can be challenging for folks in some ways, but I do it on purpose because then the invitation is, if you want to lead in the 21st century, this is a non-negotiable. You will have to listen to women of color. You will have to follow women of color. You will have to follow people of color. You have to change how you think about leadership. You can choose to not do that, but the demographics have already shown we're going to be a majority minority country in our lifetime. And so the question becomes if your leadership will be obsolete or if you will be a part, you can ride the wave as it is coming because it is coming.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so good. That embodiment piece is interesting. This morning I was in my garden with my husband and there's this, I planted this pot of these flowers, all these seeds. I just dropped them in the pot and they've all come up and they need to be separated into separate pots so that they can flourish. And we were walking through the garden, looking, checking on everything. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to move those, or I'm thinking about moving those. And he looked at me and he said, if you think about it, it's never going to happen. You need to do it.
Wow.
And I was like, don't be rude. It's morning time. Wow. It's my garden walk. But
thank you. Yes. Wait for the coffee, please, before you give all these truths.
But it was so true. So you can't think about it. You have to do it. And so even hearing what you're saying and, you know, mirroring back to me the content about embodiment in my book, it's so true. It's like you think about it to a point, which I think is because, you know, there's probably fear in there, some perfectionism in there, the thinking that if you can check it off in your box intellectually or in your brain intellectually, then you'll be done. But it really does come down to what you're doing with your body, where you're physically going, and the words you're actually saying, and tending to the anxiety and the stories that you feel in your gut, and that makes your shoulders get tense. Like it really is so much self-management and self-redirection in order to create the kinds of cultures we say we want in our organizational lives. And so leaders who are listening, be thinking about that. For you, Sean, I want to ask you a little bit about history. And I know that you studied history and that you are preparing to teach a workshop that I'm imagining you'll have some history context in. I wonder just how do you bring history into the room in a way that feels salient for people, in a way that doesn't incline them to check it off. I learned about slavery in my fourth grade classroom. Whatever it might be. I'm wondering what that looks like for you as you continue in your training work with Be the Bridge.
Yeah, again, that's an excellent question. I'm definitely thinking about it. I've got the seminary class that I'm getting ready to teach at Gordon Conwell, which starts this Wednesday. We'll look at, we'll go through, it's 7 weeks. We'll look at a biblical understanding of diversity. Week two is, I'm calling it decolonizing Christian history, not demolishing, but decolonizing it. We'll look at we'll look at indigenous theology, Black theology, Latinx theology, Asian theology. And then week seven is, well, where do we go from here? And so you're absolutely right. I think history is a huge component of it. I tell one joke about it, and then I tell one serious point about it. And so I'll give you both. In terms of the joke, I always say the same thing. I'm from Houston, Texas, born and raised. And during the summers, you had to stay at my grandmother's house. And that was back in the 80s. And so I had to watch Price is Right, Young and the Restless, All My Children, One Life to Live, Days of Our Lives, and General Hospital. Like, it was a non-negotiable. I thought Victor Newman was a real person on Young and the Restless. I thought he was alive. I wanted to work for him. I didn't know that brother sold perfume. Like, I was just like, I was on the train. And I remember I was 12 years old, and Nick Newman went upstairs. He was 10 on the show at the time. Nick had a headache, and he went upstairs to take a nap. And like, the dramatic music was playing. It's a Friday. 10-year-old Nick Newman goes upstairs to take a nap. Monday, when he came downstairs, he was 26 years old. He had a beard and he was dating Sharon. And I remember being very confused. And I told my grandmother, I was like, no, Nick is a boy. This is a man, because Nick was the only person on the show that I was older than. And, you know, they had retconned the character. They had a narrative story that they wanted to be able to tell about Nick Newman, and they couldn't tell it if he was a boy. So they retconned him and turned him into a man. And it happens in our entertainment all the time. I am a massive, massive superhero nerd, proud of it, rep it till the day I die. Superman could not originally fly. He's able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. He can jump. Captain America wasn't originally frozen in ice. They retconned these characters in these superhero stories. Again, we do an entertainment all the time, and that's fine. It's not okay when it happens in American history. And if you have been educated in the United States of America, myself included, we all have been given a retconned version of history. We have been given a version of history to fit the narrative that needed to be told about American exceptionalism. And so the difficult work that all of us have to do is to go back and ask, we need a reckoning, as Oprah Winfrey says when she talks about Bryan Stevenson's work with the Equal Justice Initiative and the lynching memorial. We need a reckoning. We need truth-telling to be an integral part of this work. And so that's one of the first principles that I tell people. Is like, we're not telling you lies. The whole notion that, you know, critical race theory is destroying the country or all these different things, we can have a philosophical conversation about that. But one of the clear components of that is, let's just tell the truth about what happened. You don't have to agree with it. We don't have to like it. Let's just tell the truth about what happened from all of these different ethnic groups. The Navajo have a saying, we trust our memory better than your history, because they know American history is not accurate. It's not right. It's not true. And so I think that's one part of it, right? It's the reclaiming the history that's been retconned and changed and done away with. And the other thing really is when we study reconciliation philosophy, reconciliation theology, you cannot have conflicting narratives in a society and have reconciliation. We can have different points of view and different perspectives. For example, Bethany, if you and I are, I don't know, at an intersection and our cars collide, we can both get out of the car and, hey, are you okay? Whatever the whole nine. If my sister is in the car with me, that's two different perspectives from my car. Your husband's in the car with you, that's two different perspectives. We've got four perspectives. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah. But if you and I get out of our cars, I'm like, why did you hit me? You ran your stop sign. You're like, Sean, you T-boned me. We have conflicting narratives on what just happened. Call the insurance adjusters, they're going to do an investigation. Mm-hmm. And in America, we have conflicting narratives on how we got here, who we are as a nation, and who we actually want to be. Mm-hmm. And until we change that, it's just going to be a difficult journey. So I challenge people in that, in order to be able to know what exactly is going on, you have to know history. You have to know that we weren't given the full picture of what's taking place in the country. Mm-hmm. And the energy and passion, the defensiveness that people have about defending this version of America that they've been taught, you have to recognize that's a conflicting narrative that's not based in truth. And so in order for us to move forward, we have to have some truth telling, and we have to accept the truth that has been told to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So tricky. It's one of those things that someone could have told me years ago, truth telling is important. And I would think, yes, of course. But now seeing how much people are willing to not only lie, but to erase, to diminish, like factual history, not even opinions, facts. Facts. It is. It's like, wow, stories are powerful. Yeah, like derive so much of our sense of self, power, place in the world through the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. And I don't think I knew just how true that was until the last couple of years. We have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was telling somebody else too, I think it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago, like the whole flat earth theory came back out again. Kyrie Irving, who's an NBA player, if you don't know him, for the listeners. And, you know, he's just like he was back on the flat earth train, the whole nine. And renowned astrophysicist, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson was being interviewed. And they're like, you work at NASA, you're brilliant. You're always doing these, you know, scientific facts on TikTok and everywhere else. What do you think about the flat earth theory? And he said something that was water on my black soul. He said, I don't debate facts. He said, we can have a philosophical discussion about ideas and opinions on things, but what is historically data supported, scientifically proven facts, I don't debate those. Mm-hmm. And it shifted in my mind how I approach these conversations. We have a vetting form that we do at Be the Bridge. There are organizations that we fundamentally will not work with. Like, the starting point has to be racism exists, white supremacy is in the DNA of America, and we want to learn how to dismantle it. If their starting process is convince me of these things, convince me that what you're saying is actually a history, convince me that racism exists, we aren't the organization for you. I am not the leader for you. Or if I can be petty, add a comma, I'm going to charge you a lot more money, because that's just not our job, I think, to be able to convince people of the truth, like you were saying. There's just, I think, for our own self-care and for our longevity as leaders in this work, mm-hmm. we've got to be able to have some boundaries that says if you're at a stage in which you don't believe the truth, mm-hmm. that's a different stage of life that I can't help you in that. We mm-hmm. have to start with the truth if we're going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I similarly, in my vetting process, and it's just me, little old me, yeah, and my team of facilitators. And so my process isn't that intense, but in conversation with potential partners, it is always that question of, hey, look, do you already know there's a problem and you're trying to solve it? Or are you waiting for someone to teach you about the problem? Because I can't do that. I could, but I'm not going to, because I have boundaries and I value myself and my time too much. But if you mm-hmm. know that you have a problem, racism is real, you want to do something about it, then then let's talk. We will find the pace that works for you. We will determine what success looks like for you. But there does have to be that baseline of I've done my own work. I see the problem. I just am ready to level up and I need support. And I find also for DEI practitioners who are listening to this episode, I was thinking about this morning. I was trying to play out. I don't know if you ever do this as you're working with organizations, but sometimes I find myself playing out conversations with people in my head
all the time.
Exactly. Like I'm trying to play out the whole thing so I can think about it strategically and, you know, figure out how to help people learn, how to help people understand the problem. And I was thinking about this one potential client and their demographics. It's an all white team, they're an older generation than me. And so just in a different place than I am and than our peers probably are. And I found myself in my mind going down this rabbit trail about CRT, about critical race theory and history. And I just had to check myself. I was like, Bethany, you are over-functioning. This is not your work to do. A, this isn't a partner that you have yet. B, this isn't your identity. And C, you aren't in the business of convincing people of the problem. And I really had to have that conversation with myself.
Before
I proceeded to spend another hour ruminating on how to convince this person of a problem I know that they aren't yet ready to grapple with.
Exactly. Boundaries. Mm-hmm. It's real. And like precisely what you said too, it's a slippery slope. Like we don't even realize it. You can, you know, have a vetting form. You can have an initial conversation with them. And as you begin to replay the conversations, the body language in those Zoom meetings, right? You're like, oh, wait, that rubbed them the wrong way. So let me, so that's where they are on their journey. Now, how do I convince, no, that's not my job. Like, you know, I think Dr. Brittany Cooper, she said, your desire to learn does not produce in me a desire to educate. And what I have seen from Black women in particular who are leading and doing this work across the board, within BIPOC, and I think the elders of our communities, all of them, they very much have a firm boundary. You have got to do some work and you have got to be working. You cannot be at a standstill expecting, I think, people of color doing DEI work to carry you into the next chapter and season of your life. You've got to be willing to do the work. And so there's a gentleman, he just became the COO at Be The Bridge. So I have to stop calling that. He's my boss now. He just got promotion, but a guy named Micah Smith. And so we parade Micah around really. He's an introvert and drives him nuts sometimes, but we were really, really, really proud of him. Micah's white and he's from Tennessee. And Micah's story is just very powerful. He played General Robert Lee in the reenactments for the Civil War when he was younger. For his bachelor's and his master's, he wrote as a thesis that slavery was not the cause of the Civil War. Just very like drenched in conservative political and theological ideologies without question. And so, but Micah's, what changed Micah's life was when Eric Garner was killed. And Micah said, you know, he believed in a black-white binary in terms of ethics and government, right? You break the law, you go to jail. Innocent people aren't killed. And Micah said, I saw a man be choked to death on camera for selling single cigarettes. This fundamentally didn't make sense. It didn't fit his worldview and his framework for how the world was to operate. And Micah said, I realized everybody in my life that I was talking to about this was white. And so he did what we ask everyone to do in this work. He became autodidactic. He became self-taught. That man went on Google. He found some books. He went on YouTube and he just started learning. Mm-hmm. Stumbled upon Tasha and Be The Bridge, joined the Be The Bridge group, changed his life, continued to grow, was active in our Facebook group. We got him to start writing some of our whiteness education content because we want to have white people helping to educate other white people just because of the racial dynamics in the country. And Mike has just grown tremendously. Again, he's now the chief operating officer at Be The Bridge because of his own journey. And we tell Mike's story often because precisely what you said, it's not our job to convince you that racism is real. Something changed in Micah that said, I have to, Jim Collins, John Maxwell, 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, the law of the lid. You don't know what you don't know. And so Micah made a decision to say, there is a lot that I don't know about this world and about this work. And he took it upon himself to learn those things. I think when we've got people that are teachable, you know this as well as I do, it just makes our jobs easier. If I have to come in and try to convince you of these realities, if it's the whataboutisms, I am, God bless your heart in all parts. Here's a number of books to read. Here's some podcasts to listen to. holler at me in 5 years. So mm-hmm. it's just, you can't do it. So you've mm-hmm. got to be able to know. And I think about that too, as I'm turning 40 this year, it's like, where do I want to invest my time and my energy? What's my own legacy that I'm thinking about? And so I want to pour into people that see the problem, that want to change personally. They want their organizations and their churches to change. They want the world to be a better place for their kids and their grandkids. That invigorates me. So that I want to commit my life to.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, as we land the plane here, I have a couple of questions left.
I'll be good. I won't be as long-winded. I told you I'm Baptist preacher.
You are perfect. I'm just really enjoying learning from you, and I could probably talk to you all day. This has been really rich. I want to know how you are moving through and processing, in as much as you want to share. Yeah. You don't feel the need to like pour out all the things in your journal. If you journal, I journal.
You have to in this work. Yes.
You have to be self-reflective, but how are you moving through and processing the events of, last weekend, what happened in Buffalo?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Honestly, I'm numb. I have been numb, in full transparency, since Philando Castile and Alton Sterling were killed in the same day in 2016. That was the last time that I watched the video of a shooting. That was the last time that I followed the news reports, read all of the articles. A good friend of mine, she said, I think up until that point for us, we saw those things and we didn't get over, but we were able to move past it. But having those two killed in the same day, it was just sticky. It just stuck with us. It named the reality of what it meant to be a person of color in America, that all of the misnomers, the lies, the deceptions, the half-truths, all of the talking points, they were muted at that point. It's like, the country is racist. We've changed the laws. The hearts of the people haven't changed. Black people are expendable. The end. And so I think looking at Buffalo, it's painful. I was a college pastor for 12 years. And so in some respects, I'm like, this kid is 18. No disrespect to anybody 18. Nobody is smart at 18. What do we know? We know nothing. You are immortal. You can eat a Snickers for lunch and be fine. we know nothing at 18. There are very few people at 18 that have a good head on their shoulders. And so that old adage of what monster got to him first that turned him into that? I believe that the college age, 18 to 21 or 22, is a pivotal time in your life. That if we can have a conversation with you then and give you some principles to help change the course of your life, you'll be better throughout that. So it broke my heart about Trayvon Martin. He was 17. And so we've got this 18-year-old kid that has killed 10 people. His life is over. Like there's no recovery from that. There can be redemption for him, but there is no recovery from that. He will spend the rest of his life in jail. And so that hurts, I think, as a pastor. I think as a Black man living in America, it's terrifying. Yeah. No place is safe. We can't go to grocery stores. We can't go to amusement parks. We can't go to church. We can't be home. Breonna Taylor would sleep in her bed. And so it's just that visceral reminder that I don't feel safe in spaces and places. And so I'm walking lightly this week. My radar is at 110%. I'm checking my surroundings at all times. I live in Texas and we are tripping down here. So it's unnerving. I'll say this and I'll pass it back. It's what pops up in my mind is because I wanted to believe part of what she said, and I'm still wrestling with it. When they decided to be a non-indictment for Darren Wilson, the person that killed Michael Brown, the police officer that killed Michael Brown. I remember they announced it right before Thanksgiving, and I drove home to Houston, and my friends, we were all upset. We were trying to figure out what protests we were going to, what were we going to write about, how were we going to change our leadership styles. And I got home, and my mom, who at that time was turning 70, she's 77 now, but she was in the kitchen, and she was just smiling and peaceful. And I had not seen a smiling Black person in 3 days since that non-indictment had come back. And I remember asking my mom about it. And I just was like, you're in a good mood. I haven't seen a Black person be in a good mood since this happened. And she just looked at me very calmly and said, Sean, I'll be 70 next month. I have forgotten the names of all of the unarmed Black people killed in this country. You are young and you still have hope. I know what it means to be Black in America. This never stops. And I've told people, like, my mom had so much hopeless peace. She did not have any hope that the country was going to change, but there was a peace that she had that I wrestled with because of, I need to have hope that America can change, that people can change. That's why we do this work. But I am not at peace with what's happening in the country. And so it's weird to live in that juxtaposition. And I don't want to say that my mother was right, but I understand what she's saying. These things are not stopping. It doesn't matter how many books we read, how much we lead and what's going on. There is a fundamental problem that exists within the dominant culture of the United States of America. And they need to have a candid conversation with each other about what it means to live on Earth with the rest of us. And so I feel that tension because I want to walk outside and check my mail and not be horrified if I see a neighbor. I want to be able to wave and say good morning to people and not worry if that person is a white supremacist or if that person thinks that I'm an other and therefore I'm a danger to their family. So it's it's all of these notions in the midst of that. But then, as you know, we have to bracket all of that and be professionals because there are teachable white people out there that want to learn and grow. And so we have to embody the hope and the change that we want to see. So it's, I'm living in the tension of those realities. Yes. So yeah. How about you?
Ooh, good question. I really resonate with what your mother said.
Yeah.
Even coming off of the conversation I had with my great uncle yesterday.
Yeah.
I didn't have language for it, but that's what he was carrying as well. Yeah. A hopeless peace.
Yeah.
And a little bit, he saw a little bit of outrage, his personality, but very much a hopeless peace. And I think that speaks to not exactly where I am, but I'm in the tension of that because perhaps similar to you, I was involved in InterVarsity as a student when I was in college. Yes. And so that might be a whole other conversation here in Georgia. So I'm very familiar with InterVarsity. But then also being a college student and believing you can change the world and being a part of like these incredible organizations and these missions and all of these different things. And so to be in my early 30s now and to realize, oh, wow, I don't think world change happens like I thought it did. Yeah. It's not quite like my asset-based community development notebook told me it would be. it's not the 10 steps of reconciliation from that first book I read. It is something else entirely. And I don't know what it means for me to be a Black woman in the midst of all of this. A Black woman in a rural Southern community. I have no idea. And I'm just taking it a day at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's real. There's I did not know you're in InterVarsity and you're in Georgia too. Oh, I got questions. Yeah. I'm like, I bet I know your coworker. I mean, your staff workers. There's a gentleman in Atlanta. His name, we call him Bishop, but Tony Warner. He's one of the early Black staff with InterVarsity, and similar conversations, shootings are going on. All of us young Black staff, we are hot as fish grease and ready to protest and march and burn everything down and flip over every table. And Bishop was in his 70s, just sitting there drinking his coffee, just cool and calm and collected. And I'm, you're not mad. He's like, of course I'm mad. He said, Sean, all y'all have been taught wrong. He said, you have been taught that you can change the world completely in your lifetime, that you plus Jesus, you can go out in 10 steps, like you said, and solve all those problems. And he said, we forget Israel waited 400 years for Moses. And he said, very few of us have the opportunity to see God change the world from 0 to 10. And he said, we have to realize, and your generation will learn, your job is to move folks from 0 to 1 or from 1 to 1.5 or 2 to 4. But that's it. It's very few of us that get the opportunity to see a complete and dramatic change. You know, folks waited for slavery to end. Folks waited for the Civil Rights Act. Folks waited for separate but equal to become unconstitutional. And so he said that, and I've held it in my heart because, you know, there is this hope that we have to have in doing this work. But, you know, I think when we look in scripture as well too, the scriptures are true. There are people that waited, I think, for all these tremendous things to happen that they didn't see in their lifetime. The next generation saw it, or two generations later. And so I am trying to, my favorite skit from Mad TV, lowered expectations. I'm trying to have lowered expectations about what's happening in the country. Where are we going? And what's the, like, you know, as I look back over my life and my own legacy, what would be the win for me? Because I think, like you, I'm like, I'm joining this work. America's going to not be racist by the time I retire. Woo! That was too lofty of a goal. Okay. I want to help people in this generation discover the realities of what lives in a multi-ethnic, multicultural community, whoever God would give me influence. Merry Christmas. Let's do that one, right? So it's hard. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Sean. I'm just really inspired by you and grateful for you. Thank you for this time and for being part of this conversation. I am sure that it's going to be a gift to the listeners and it's been a real gift to me.
Thank you very much, Bethany. I greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate it. Before we go, I did want to say it. I want to say it at the beginning and it slipped my mind, but I want to say it at the end too. This book is phenomenal. Like, I was blown away by it. I'm sure, you know, in doing the work, we are oversaturated or inundated with resources and diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we get them all the time to be the bridge. I'm sure you get them as well too. Everything from endorsements to reading these things. And so we got your book in the mail, and I remember, thanks for sending it to, and we got it in the mail and I read the cover and then said, so let me take out the table of contents real quick. I was like, all right, let me just kind of outline the book. Wait a minute. She's got something to say. It's just absolutely phenomenal. The ways in which you're able to name those realities and those frameworks. It is, you take these very deep and complex issues, but you communicate them in a way that's so palatable for people across the diaspora and across organizations and cultures. I use your content in our main trainings. I tell people to be able to use it as a resource. We're actually, I've already told our director of marketing, it needs to be on our website as a recommended resource for people. It really is outstanding. And so I want to be able to commend you as a brother to a sister. I know that there are a lot of Black women who are leading in this work, and patriarchy is real. So I want to say you are doing a phenomenal job. I am following you and I am very proud of the work that you are doing. This is an excellent resource. It's in my library. My coworkers and friends and our clients, I'm going to make sure they use it as well too. So thank you really for the opportunity to be here and for this resource, Bethany. It really is phenomenal.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you. Of course. Mm-hmm.